Welcome, friends, to the Ink to Film podcast, where we read the book and then see the movie. I'm filmmaker James Bailey.
And I'm writer Luke Elliott.
And this week, we are taking a break. We are going to release a previous Patreon-exclusive episode. It's a From the Vault episode, and it's covering Sandman Season 1, but just the episode that was released afterwards, Episode 11, which kind of had a cool release schedule to it.
Yeah, it was like a little bonus thing they put out after the main season was done. And it covered some of the stuff that we weren't sure if we were going to get from the comics, and that was like a very cat based episode and the Calliope episode, and so it was a cool little thing they released, and we did this bonus episode around the time it came out. And then I think at the end of this, we also are reacting to the first episode of House of the Dragon. I don't really remember what we said, but I know we were excited about it, and I think we talk about it at the end some there. So if you want to hear these things like as they're coming out, that's where you're going to want to be on Patreon, and you can get these like as soon as we drop them.
Yeah, because we are excited now having it confirmed. We're getting a season 2 of The Sandman, which I don't know that we had confirmed at the time.
I think we theorize about it in here.
And House of the Dragon season 2 is definitely coming very soon as well. So we're very excited about it. And then we may at some point possibly cover House of the Dragon as like a full project in the main feed. But this is kind of our first initial reactions to what I would say is a positive look at more A Song of Ice and Fire after, the end of the final season left us kind of frustrated.
Yeah. I think we were excited. I think we were cautiously optimistic. And then I remember enjoying the rest of that season. But yeah, enjoy this. We will be back in the following week with our Casino Royale film episode. So you can look forward to that. But until then, enjoy this previous Patreon exclusive.
This week, we will be talking about the surprise bonus episode that The Sandman put out, Neil Gaiman's The Sandman. Great surprise to us because it came out the day that we released our episode, and I was excited that we had more Sandman.
Yeah, and it kind of invalidated a couple things we said on that episode where we were talking about these like weird issues at the end that weren't in the show, and that was one of the things we really liked about, even though like we had mixed feelings about them, it was still cool to see these like bizarre cat dream thing and like all this stuff, and then now all of a sudden it's in the actual show. It kind of changes things a little bit, so yeah, definitely excited to talk about it. It came out as one episode 11, but it's like a two-parter. The Dream of a Thousand Cats is fairly short. I think it was only about like 16-17 minutes. Yeah. And then the Calliope episode is almost a full length, like 45-48 something like that minute episode. So it felt more like a complete episode of Sandman, whereas the Cats one is just this kind of fun little mini short thing, and it's animated, and yeah, I know. Let's focus on the Cat one first. Yeah. I think.
I think that my enthusiasm for the Cat one showed up in our episode. Like, I really just thought it was fun, a fun bit of storytelling. Still keeps in line with a lot of the things that I love about Sandman, and just it's showing that like these really clever, unique kind of storytelling things that Neil Gaiman wants to do, he can achieve in this medium of the Sandman in the comic, and then getting to see it adapted and with that very unique looking animation style. That's, I don't even know how to describe that. I'm not really sure what
it's
that's
like.
Called.
It reminded me of Arcane a little bit. It's this like, it looks like it's been hand drawn, but blended in a way with that CGI 3D element. I'm not sure how it's done, but
I think it was like clearly CG created.
Yeah.
Like in a some whatever three-dimensional world. And then there was an attempt to make it look like frames were taken out so that it was a little more jumpy, like an animator would do.
Oh, like Into the Spider-Verse kind of looks like that.
Something like that. Like they wanted to give that feeling that it was hand-drawn. Yeah. But then it was so, there's also a realism look to it. It kind of reminds me of like almost like rotoscope as well.
It might be something like that. Yeah, I don't know. It looks great. And what a cast, I'll just reference a few of them here. We have Tom Sturridge, obviously, returning as the Cat of Dreams. But then we have a bunch of people who aren't in the show proper who got to show up. We got Sandra Oh as the prophet, the main cat. We have James McAvoy, who plays this golden-haired man. This is almost just like a cameo, just for a second.
Quick cameo.
We have David Tennant, who was the voice of Dawn, which I'm not sure. Is that the voice of a cat that comes to pick up the main cat? The tabby kitten, whose name is Rosie Day. That's the name of the actor. So, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that, because they just say, like, Dawn. And I'm like, I'm not sure which cat that is.
Yeah, Dawn. Well, notably, Dawn and Paul are David Tennant and Michael Sheen.
Yeah, Michael Sheen. So, Good Omens fame, connection to Gaiman.
Another Doctor Who reference as well in Gaiman's The Sandman now, with David Tennant actually being a doctor showing up. So that was cool.
So cool. And then Neil Gaiman himself is the voice of this crow with like a skull. Did you immediately recognize his voice?
Oh, yeah.
As soon as he started talking, I was so excited. I was like, it's Neil Gaiman.
I have heard Gaiman narrate some of his own stories before. I think maybe something we've listened to potentially.
Yeah, he did a reading
Coraline.
Yeah, maybe he did do the audiobook for Coraline. I know he did it for The Ocean at the End of the Lane, which we haven't covered because it's, you know, it's the only adaptation for that is a stage adaptation, I think. But I really like that book, and I think he read that one. I can't remember if he also read Coraline or not, but I've definitely listened to that. I know he did a reading of, like, The Raven, I think, around Halloween one year that came out on, like, YouTube, and I watched that. He's just got a great reading voice.
He's great, and, like, what a performer. Like, he brings a lot to it. And I turned to my girlfriend, and she was like, oh, my God, is that him? And I was like, who? And she's like, Dream. And I was like, no, not Dream, but a very notable voice. And I was like, have you ever heard Gaiman's voice before? And she was like, no. And that's when I revealed. I was like, that's Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, he does have just a notable voice. Like, it's very unique. I'm jealous of it. I wish I could read, like, Neil Gaiman.
I know.
I think part of it's slowing down. That's the one thing I got to remember is that, like, part of what makes his voice so good is he just speaks very slowly.
He's also British.
And he's British, which, British. Like, you know, that just be British. That'll help a lot.
That'll help. We also, just another couple people, David Gyasi played the gray cat. Georgia Tennant played a character as well, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, Laura Lynn. Maybe that's, like, that might be one of the human characters.
I think so.
I'm not sure, unfortunately, like, because we don't, like, they have names in the cast list, but I don't see a lot of them with names. You know, we don't get their names in the episode.
Yeah. Most of them are pretty quick. Like, James McAvoy is like, if I didn't know he was in it, I don't know that. Like, I saw Neil Gaiman's tweet, which is how I, like, we're actually referencing this right now. And he was like, look how good this cast is for this episode. And if you didn't know, I think you missed the James McAvoy. It's so quick. Yeah.
So there was a adaptation for Audible of the comic, and a lot of these actors appear in that Audible adaptation playing different roles for the Sandman comics. So I'm wondering if that was kind of how this happened, because it feels like there's a lot of them that made it into this. I think James McAvoy is one of them, right? Like, I feel like if I
remember correctly, James McAvoy might be Dream.
Yeah, and then you got I think Michael Sheen and David Tennant are both in the in that Audible adaptation as well. So
that's so cool.
Yeah, and then he got them all. I mean, like, it's just voice acting, right? So they probably, maybe they were doing that, and maybe they could even use some of it. I don't know. They probably re-recorded it, but, like, if they did this issue, you could probably use some of the same stuff and just put it in the animated. I don't know. But Sturridge, I don't believe, was in the Audible version, so at the very least, Sturridge is completely new.
I do think that I'm going to go back and listen to that, because I remember people freaking out when it came out about how good, like, in terms of, like, an audio performance, I've heard that Sandman run is, like, incredible.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be really cool to listen to, definitely. We should dip into that sometime, and we can touch back in later.
Yeah, so I'm going to read the synopsis of the episode real quick, just to give us a jumping off point. The episode is called Dream of a Thousand Cats. Late one night, a Siamese cat holds a gathering of other cats to tell her story about her encounter with Morpheus. A long time ago, she met a tomcat with whom she gave birth to a litter of mixed-breed kittens. This displeased her owners, who took the kittens and threw them into a river, traumatizing the Siamese cat. In desperation, the cat dreamed of meeting Morpheus in the form of a black cat and begged him for a solution. Morpheus presents her with a parallel universe in which cats were the dominant species over humans until they fought back by dreaming, turning them into the cats mankind sees them as they are today. Upon finishing her story, the Siamese cat urges the other cats to perform the same enlightenment, to which they will reclaim their status as the rulers of the earth.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like a cute, funny story with one, like, pretty harrowing sequence where the kittens are tossed into the river with the brick in the bag. And that was just as heartbreaking, you know, honestly, seeing it on screen. I was watching with my wife, and it was definitely like I contemplated warning her about it because she's pretty sensitive to that kind of stuff. You know, it's definitely affecting. And but I think by the time it comes back around, like, you're just kind of left with this feeling of, like, yeah, this is kind of a fun idea. And, like, I saw people posting pictures of themselves, of their cats watching the episode, and people are responding like, oh, what are you doing? Don't do that.
Someone told me, so my dog stared at the screen the entire time with the cats meowing and everything, and someone told me that their dog like jumped up and tried to get the cats.
Oh, that's funny.
Like tried to attack the TV. So that's, I think it's definitely an episode that's primed to get everybody's cat, pets all riled up.
Yeah. Well, and it, yes, also, I mean, like, we're on our way to 1,000 cats, you know, so we got to be careful. Right. We're all going to be snacks. Okay. So, I mean, I don't have a lot of thoughts other than that. It was fun. It looked good. But I do have more thoughts about Calliope episode. So if you're ready, we can move into that one.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
So the episode's called Calliope. Struggling author Richard Maddock visits Erasmus Fry, an elderly former writer who has imprisoned a Greek muse named Calliope, in his house. Fry transfers ownership of Calliope, the muse, to Maddock, who discovers that by raping her, he receives inspiration. He does this more than once, despite his promises, until it becomes obvious he never intends to let her go. Calliope sends a desperate plea to Morpheus, her former husband, whom she has not seen since the tragic death of their son, Orpheus. Upon receiving her plea and learning of what has happened to her, Morpheus becomes enraged and confronts Maddock. When he refuses to release Calliope, Morpheus punishes Maddock with an uncontrollable stream of ideas. Maddock soon frees Calliope, who asks Morpheus to lift his curse off Maddock. Morpheus lifts the curse of too many ideas, but Maddock finds himself unable to remember Calliope, Morpheus, or any of his ideas. Calliope vows to make sure what happened to her doesn't happen to anyone else. She and Morpheus share a tender goodbye, with her expressing hope that sometime in the future she can visit him in his realm and they'll be able to grieve their son properly.
Oh man, a lot to react to in this episode. First off, this was an issue in the comic that I felt super conflicted about. On one hand, I loved the metaphor for storytelling and like the lengths that writers will go to. And creatives will go to. I like seeing an author who is so desperate that he's turned to essentially sell his soul, which he kind of does here, through the, you know, the actions he's willing to take, right? And he dooms himself, and you know, the writers are liars, and there's so many fun sort of meta textual things talking about what it's like to be a creative and what it's like to be a writer, that was updated in this version to modern day. I thought a lot of that was super fun. But in the comic, I think both of us, we didn't react super well to the depiction of the sexual assault. I know that in the comic, the Calliope was basically nude in like every frame she was in, almost. It depicted a lot of the sexual assault was like on the page. And it ended up just seeming like poor taste to me at best, and at, you know, at worst, like potentially harmful and, you know, pretty awful, honestly. And I was a little concerned when I saw that they were making it. I'm like, how is this gonna come off in live action when you got real people? Because in some ways it can be a lot worse when you do that, right? And you got actual human beings. I was really pleased personally with how it was depicted. I felt like they did a good job of reining in some of the more unforgivable elements of the comic and instead replace it with at least a more like careful and nuanced approach, while still maintaining the story, right? Like in the kind of the metaphor that's happening here.
Realistically, the awful events are kind of the same. It's just we're getting less of it, and it's not seemingly more,
it's not shown to be titillating,
exploitive, and
and the focus is a lot more on Calliope, in my opinion, than in the comic. In the comic, it felt like it was a lot more on Richard Maddock. Whereas we get a lot of him too, but we got a lot of sense of Calliope as a person. She asserts her personhood more, I think, in the show, saying how she's not a thing and how she was born. And some of that, I think, is in the comic, but it felt like there was more of an emphasis on it. And that gave her a little more agency within the story. And she even tries to escape on her own. She's, you know, more active in the pursuit of Morpheus and trying to get him to help. All of that, I think, did a lot for this story.
Even their relationship, too, was built up a lot more, I felt. Like, we got it. Like, it did happen kind of the same way in the comic, but we got more of the conversation between them and, like, what has gone on in the history that they share.
Well, they reveal some new details we did not know in the comics. Yeah.
That's true. This Doctor Who stuff is everywhere right now. Okay. And the person who plays Maddock His name is Arthur Darvill, played Rory in Doctor Who.
Okay.
Who was a companion alongside Amelia Pond, who is Karen Gillan. They are companions alongside Matt Smith as the 11th Doctor. And Matt Smith, we might talk about a little bit here at the
House
end,
of the Dragon.
Is in House of the Dragon. So there's a lot of these actors are floating. And then we had David Tennant in this one before. So I love to see it. You know, Doctor Who's a very campy show that's like existed for a really long time. It's had good seasons and bad seasons and great episodes and bad episodes. But it's fun to be a fan of it. And I do think that there's something, if you're into like sci-fi stories and that kind of thing, it's so much fun to see these actors who mean a lot to those stories to continue on and play these roles. And a very different character here for Arthur Darvill. He's like lovable as Rory, and here he's like unforgivable. Like we've talked about some of the things that he does as this Matic character.
Yeah. You actually sent me, speaking of Doctor Who, you sent me a TikTok recently where it was like a clip from one of the episodes, because I'm not a Doctor Who guy. I've only seen like maybe two episodes ever. It's the episode where Van Gogh is brought to like this exhibit. So if you're a Doctor Who fan, you probably know this episode because apparently it's famous. And he's shown his exhibit in the museum, and it was like pretty moving, and it was cool to see depicted. And I was thinking like, okay, if this is Doctor Who, then I can, you know, this is something I could be into. So I'm still thinking like I probably could enjoy it if I just found a way into it that, I don't know, I have yet to find.
It's definitely a great episode, and like the tragedy of it is like Van Gogh died before his influence was ever felt, and so the idea of,
I was thinking about a lot of the authors we've covered like that. Yeah. So yeah.
And so you know, Doctor is a time traveler, so right. To be able to bring an artist like that to show his influence, and there's a person like a curator in the museum who's like, I think he's nothing but the greatest artist of all time, and it was just, it's a great episode, and I figured you'd appreciate that.
Yeah, it was cool. So yeah, if you don't know that episode, maybe look up that clip of the Van Gogh episode of Doctor Who. But anyway, bringing it back to the episode we're talking about, I thought this was all handled a lot better, and sure enough, I read this article today where it was Neil Gaiman talking about how that was one of his goals in bringing this to the screen. They brought in sensitivity consultants. The showrunner whose name is escaping me, that was something they both wanted to do, was to find a way to portray this that like kept the heart alive but was up to date with modern sensibilities and made sure that the emphasis was where it should be. So a lot of the emphasis shifting to Calliope and making it about her and her journey was all deliberate and all done in an effort to sort of modernize this story that didn't age very well otherwise.
And impressively so, because I if you had told me that they were going to adapt this, I would have been like, just probably stay away from it, because it would be really difficult from what I saw on the page to make it, you know, satisfying and like a story worth telling.
Yeah.
Showrunner is Alan Hynberg.
Alan Hynberg. I was going to say Alan, but I couldn't pull the last name.
Yeah. We're on a first name basis.
We're on a first name with Alan. Yeah. Anyway, I thought that was great, man. What were your thoughts on this one?
I definitely felt that all the things that they updated helped it. I was telling my girlfriend as the episode was going on, like, oh, this is much better than I expected. Like, I kind of was saying, like, I thought this was going to get really rough. It ended up being satisfying, and it towed the line of it being clearly despicable, but not a
They didn't show it. Right. Like the only thing they really showed was him being scratched at the end. Calliope isn't nude at all the entire episode.
But like you said, it also did a good job of making the story about Calliope and like being someone who, and I felt like even in the comic, it was much more of Dream just showing up and saving the day. And Calliope, it kind of still goes that way. But Calliope has some agency in terms of like the way things are handled and saying like, you know, make it stop at some point and forgive him and that kind of thing. Ultimately, Dream still does come and save her as a damsel in distress, which isn't like the greatest of storytelling devices, but it works, I think, for what was being told here.
Well, and it felt like she really connected with the idea of like, because he had also been imprisoned.
Yeah,
she felt like he would understand. And I liked how he said like, yeah, I was in prison, but it wasn't as bad as you. Like, you've had it far worse, and like they were able to kind of connect over that. And so as much as, yeah, sure, it is a little bit damsel in distressy, it's like, I think it works better in this version. Like, they connect over a shared trauma in a sense. He's not doing it in a way that feels like it's a transaction. It just feels like it's something that he, you know, personally wants to do. And like, I don't know, we all like seeing a good vengeance, you know, story play out sometimes, right? You know, we like to see Sandman come in and be like, oh, I'm going to fuck this guy up.
Right. Especially after the times that he's been sort of morally gray in terms of like, we like our morality. We've seen him do things where we're like, oh, I wouldn't have done that, or I would have done that differently. In this moment, we're very clear about how he feels, and it's kind of a hero moment for
I mean, and like, I love that where this is positioned. Like, we've seen enough in the show now of him to know the kinds of things he's capable of, mm-hmm. and the power that he has. And we also know that, like, he recently got even more power, and like, I don't know, like, something about him saying, like, you know, oh, I'll give him plenty of ideas. Like, it's so ominous. You're like, awesome. Oh, he's about to get fucked up.
And I said it in the comic as well, but it's a great way to show the power of a character without him just doing, like, crazy blasts or anything like that. But to actually, like, influence and that power to, like, give someone too many ideas.
Oh, man. And it's so, it's like a poetic justice, right, in a way. And that's what it comes back to. And the thing that I have always loved about this story, even in the comic, is the idea of this author so desperate for ideas, he's willing to go to any lengths, and then being cursed with so many ideas, you know, that he's like writing his fingers off on the walls, which made it into the comic, or made it into to the show. Not quite as bloody and gruesome as it was in the comic, but still pretty affecting.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the idea then at the end, which I thought was really cool, or towards the end, where he says that he has no idea when he's trying to remember, and the idea of like, yeah, he's been released, but also the curse that is having no ideas on him is cool. Like, I don't know, that's a scary thing for authors. So,
yeah, and I think it's interesting that Calliope says let him go, and then he's still worse off than before, right? Like, he's actually gonna have a deficit of ideas now, like not like functioning.
One of the things I love about this whole idea is, right, like, where ideas come from for writers is always this sort of romanticized notion, and it goes all the way back to the idea of muses, right? Like, it was divine inspiration. I think the word talent even has some sort of ties to, like, divine inspiration. And so when people think about talents, they think about God-given ability that literally comes from God. And because of that, it's so externalized. But as an author and someone who's trying to write, and like, I know a lot of writers, and like, it's not very helpful to think of it that way. And in fact, it can be very detrimental. And I think that's what the story is about, right? Like, the idea that it doesn't come from within, it comes from somewhere else, is itself kind of poisonous. And if you go out searching for a muse that you want to capture, it's always going to be, you know, like, you're forcing the muse, is, you know, what's described here, versus the idea of actually, like, wooing the muse and, like, nurturing your own inner muse, if you want to think of it that way. It's like a metaphor for your own creativity and, like, being gentle with it and letting it, you know, come to you in its own time. That's going to be a better approach for creativity. Now, you complicate that as soon as you start equating it with sexuality, but I think some of that does go back to the original myth that he's touching on, so that's probably why it's here. But anyway, I find all those metaphors interesting, right? The stuff that I think about and stuff that I think a lot of creative people think about.
So just to get to the overall release of this, I love that this is like a marketing thing potentially as well, right? Like, this is smart.
Bring
people back in. And we're seeing that on display right now. Neil Gaiman has come out and said a few things recently that have got people kind of worried. And it's that, even with the success, like, The Sandman has been one of the top shows on Netflix for like the last 2 or 3 weeks now. And even with that success, Gaiman's tweeted out and basically said, like, it's not a guarantee that we have a season 2 yet. We still need everyone to come back, watch the show, tell your friends to watch the show. If you haven't finished it, finish it.
Yeah.
Because that,
well, we've been doing that. We've done our part.
Yeah. Well, I'm like, you know, it got me so emotional. I was like, maybe I just, like, put it on in the background while I'm working and stuff, like, just to, like, pump the numbers up, man.
Yeah,
do my part. So, I really do feel that way about the show. I want more of it. This 11th episode gave me a little hint of that. When I got that dopamine hit that I knew that another episode was out, I was like, holy shit, more Sandman.
I'd love to see them not just come back and say, we're going to do 2, but we're going to do 2 and 3 or 2 through 4 or something like that too, because I think there's a real freedom, and like, you can see showrunners kind of relax a little bit and take their time a little more. And I think it ends up being a better show when they're not feeling that pressure of like it has to be an instant success or it's going to get canned. Yeah. And I would like to see them relax a little bit in future seasons and develop long-term storylines they can feel like they're going to have time for.
Yeah. I mean, it's I feel good about the fact that we could get a season two with the way things are going.
I hope
that it comes that comes of it. But at the same time, like, it does worry me. Yeah. Like, if we get a season two, who's to say we don't get a season three? You know, it's a tough time right now for a show like this, especially because Neil Gaiman's made it clear it's very expensive. And I just sent you, I think I sent you another TikTok recently, I don't know if you've seen, where Sturridge talks about how they made everything. He's like, it's practical. Like, he's like, hell, pretty much all practical. Like, everything they built. So they're doing it the right way, but that makes things expensive. So I just hope that Netflix sees what they have in this, because this is a huge property and could be, like, you know, for years and years to come, could be a huge, like, cultural touchstone.
Yeah, it's tough. I know it's like, well, sometimes it comes down to these numbers games and they're like, oh, we spent X amount of money on it and we only made X amount of money back in like new subscribers or something. But like, sometimes I wish that they'd have a little bit more of a long term view, you know, like if the thing continues to build popularity, you continue to get merchandise sales, long term subscribers who stay with Netflix. I don't know how they track that, right? They often track new subscribers, but like, what about the ones who end up staying and not canceling because they have something that they want to watch and they want to stick around for?
I mean, like, I've been low on Netflix recently, and if it, you know, another drop in the bucket of Netflix doing the wrong thing, and if they get rid of Sandman, like, I'll threaten to cancel my subscription. Like, I've never not had a Netflix subscription.
What is the line from the episode? Like, the old woman pissing in the sea or something? Yeah, every little bit counts or helps or something.
Exactly. Yeah, that'd be me. I'll be pissing in the sea trying to cancel my Netflix subscription if they get rid of Sandman. I mean, I like it that much. I want more.
Yeah. So I personally think this is actually a better version of the Calliope story than what we got in the comic. I think this is the superior version. So, you know, all props to them for being able to pull that off. I do want to talk about House of the Dragon. But real quick, in this episode, there was a detail dropped that I don't think is a spoiler because it's in the show now. So if you've seen this episode, you know it. They say that Morpheus's son that he had with Calliope, his name is Orpheus. He died in Thrace, I think it was, being torn apart and is now in hell or Hades.
Hades, yeah.
And that reminds me of, do you know this Orpheus character? And like, so the game Hades we just played, but I know both of us played, has this whole long thing with Eurydice, which is another sort of myth thing. So I'm like, oh, okay, so is Orpheus going to be the son of Dream now? And does that mean we're going to see, do you think we're going to see an Orpheus character at some point in hell?
Yeah. I don't think there's any way we don't. Yeah, 100%. Especially because they know how this comic goes. So they have all of they have the whole story laid out before them. They can go pull on those things earlier, pull those strings up earlier. I am such a sucker for Greek mythology, and like there's some problematic shit in all of mythology.
For sure. I mean,
these legends and myths exist, and they're so interesting to think about in historical context, and then just to view them as stories, like these ancient myths. And the fact that Neil Gaiman is a huge fan and is a huge resource, and then threads it into a lot of his storytelling. And he's written entire books on just like mythology, yeah. Norse mythology. So.
Yeah, absolutely, man. He's an expert in a lot of this stuff, it really seems like. So let's talk about House of the Dragon a little bit here at the end. If you haven't watched it yet, we've only seen the first episode. I have read, Fire and Blood, the name of the book that the whole series is going to be based on. You haven't.
You and I spoke off air, and I know we didn't set this up at the beginning of the episode, by the way, so we're surprised we're talking about this, kind of a follow-up to us talking about Game of Thrones on the main feed, and then our season 8 sort of reaction.
Yeah. If you haven't listened to those episodes, the short of it is we both were huge fans of the show when it came out. I was a big book fan before the show ever came out.
Mm-hmm. I became a book fan.
You became a book fan, yeah. And then both of us didn't like the way it ended. So
right.
That now you're basically caught up.
But we also I think we're both invested enough in the world from George R. R. Martin's words, from his actual books, that we're willing to see more from this world. If it didn't mean that Dan and Dave were involved.
Dan and Dave are the ones doing it. Sapochnik instead is, I think, one of the showrunners.
Miguel Sapochnik,
and
too,
he has some of the best episodes of all time for Game of Thrones. So the idea of him running and, you know, being one of the showrunners is really exciting to me.
Yeah. So we talked off air, and something that I didn't realize is Fire and Blood, he's now said, is going to come out in 2 volumes, and the second volume's not out yet.
Okay, so there is going to be a second volume. So I think there, yeah, I mean, I... this won't mean a lot to you, but I think there's something called the Dance of Dragons and then Blackfyre Rebellion are two major components that happen.
I mean, I've heard of those things for
in
sure.
In Fire and Blood. They're referenced at different times in Game of Thrones as histories. And I think we're going to get Dance essentially is going to be this season, and that makes me think that the rebellion is going to be.
They can set themselves up. I also so like Aegon's conquest, and there's so much other stuff that they can dig into that George has written about. I guess they can do that in flashback too in the show if they wanted.
Well, there's also apparently other shows that are in the works. So if this does well, we might see other.
Okay, so that brings up another thing. I heard George R. R. Martin, you know, recently talking about how he wanted 10 seasons, 12, 13 seasons. He was asking for at least 10, and they were against it, and obviously that was part of it.
A lot of stuff has come out that kind of illustrates how things went wrong. And, like, sure, it all comes back to the fact that he didn't finish the books, but it also seems like Dan and Dave did not want to give it the time it needed. They were ready to move on, and Martin was not happy about that, and basically was not in touch with them anymore for a while at the end.
There was another show other than House of the Dragon that got pretty far into development with HBO, though, that was a White Walker spinoff that wasn't based in source material, and George R. R. Martin was not interested in pursuing that. Like, he was kind of against it, from what I understand, and it kind of fell through.
That, I was going to say that. I bet that didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, it's fallen through to this point.
Here's the thing I'll say about the Fire and Blood. I am excited for the idea of a show where you got Sapochnik on there who's shown that he knows how to make good TV, and then you have a story that has been written with a beginning, a middle, and an end from Martin. He wrote it in a way, like, if you ever read the book, it's very, like, it's written in this historical perspective from, like, a historian at the old town. And it's kind of dry in a way because it reads like you're reading a history. Yet there's all these really cool details that get dropped in there. So if you're interested in the details, you're like, oh, shit, this is cool. And then there are moments of narration that work really well, too. So they have a lot of room to adapt. But also the bones and the outline is very Martin. And it's a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's not a beginning, a middle, and then a question mark. So I think this show will feel like one coherent story in a way that the main show did not, because by the end it was being written by two guys who didn't give a shit about it. So to me, that gives it more potential.
For sure. And so having the source material there and we've already seen the first episode, like, what was your reaction to the first episode?
I liked it. You know, I think there's a couple things about it. Like, I think it wanted to say that, like, we're still one of the most shocking shows on television. So they had some pretty horrific violence. They had a very graphic scene with this breech birth being depicted. It was emotionally moving and heartbreaking, kind of ripped your heart out when it was revealed that the baby only lasted a day. So all of that feels very Game of Thrones to me. And it also continues to say, like, to me, this felt like a shot across the bow to Amazon a little bit of, like, yeah, you can go watch that Rings of Power show, but we want to remind you that we're different. And this is what makes Game of Thrones different, because you're going to watch that show and it's not going to feel like this. I can guarantee you that. So
I'm hearing good things, by the way, about that so far. Somebody said I saw something online about Rings of Power. But we'll see, man.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm interested in both. Like, don't get me wrong, but I think it's trying to say we're different. I think Game of Thrones has always had an allure as hushed voices, you know, like, did you watch that show? Like,
did you see that birthing scene?
Yeah. It's so intense and wild, and it's so violent. And, like, it's the kind of stuff, you know, it's on HBO, it's late at night, it's for adults very clearly. I've always liked that about Game of Thrones. Like, I know a lot of people turn their nose up about it, but, like, I think that's cool. And it's always appealed to me. And I think that works in all those ways. Now, I will say, like, right now, the story feels fairly straightforward. We see a bad dude what's his name? Prince Aegon?
Daemon.
Daemon. Prince Daemon. Yeah. Seems like a bad dude. And then we see the princess, who is now next in line. She seems good. So we have,
Rhaenyra,
like, a pretty straightforward good versus evil setup. But I think there's room for that to grow and become more complex in the way that we're used to, where you'll start getting multiple factions being involved and more gray areas. Whereas right now, he seems kind of like a proto Joffrey type. And
kind of. I thought he was more like a Jaime type.
He's like a blend between the two, which is scary, right? Like, he's kind of Jaime, kind of Joffrey. You know, definitely a shithead, but also he's got that Targaryen. He runs through a little bit of Viserys, you know, the brother from early on, season one.
Danny's brother, yeah.
Yeah. You know, he's interesting and definitely seems like he's going to be a big problem going forward. I know a little bit, but honestly, I also have forgot a lot of what happens. So, you know, in my defense, I don't remember exactly how it plays out.
And even if, you know, the story's already there, so the mystery for it'll be like book readers already knowing back in Game of Thrones days how it ends and everything. So book readers already know what's going on, and I don't think that takes away from anything. Like, the mystery will be, you know, somewhat still there for show watchers.
Well, and how it's going to be depicted is going to be very exactly. different, because that book is not written in the same way that the core Game yep. of Thrones books are, where there's like actual narration.
From what I understand, you also have opportunity to explore the other houses and factions in ways that sort of historical like look back doesn't get into.
I thought it was cool, man, seeing the big huge version of the Iron Throne with all the swords and, you know, the king's cutting himself on it, which is a detail right from the histories. Very cool, right? Like, seeing how the realm was different back then, and, you know, you see the gold cloaks, you know, basically getting out there and chopping off hands and, you know, dicks and whatever else, and pretty graphic stuff. And then you got like I'm always a sucker for a cool jousting sequence. And like, we got some pretty epic ones with that, with this surprise Dornishman who was a mystery knight and actually like held his own against Daemon and bested him in the end. Like,
if I could just say one thing that I wish they didn't do, it was that the very beginning shot. They shouldn't have said anything about Danny. They should have just said, this is 150 or 170 years before.
I bet there was a lot of discussion about that, whether or not to mention it. Yeah.
They shouldn't have. They could have said.
It immediately put a sour taste in my mouth, because it just reminded me of how unhappy I was with how the story played out with Danny.
I think they have this like rose-tinted view back of what they did with Danny, and I'm like, you guys didn't do it justice.
I think it's more that they feel married to it, so they have to. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think, like, they're not going to remake the final season. You know what I mean? Like, it's just not going to happen. So they're married to it now. That is their canon that they're going to have to live with, and for better or for worse. So I think that's them trying to do it.
One of the things that stands out to me that's good is, I felt immediately like these are some Game of Thrones characters. Like, the characters stood out to me. It
feels like Martin again, right? And we haven't felt Martin in a while in Game of Thrones. To me, he's been absent. All of a sudden, we're back in his world. I don't know. And, like, you know, some people don't like it, but, like, I've been a fan of his, and I've liked Game of Thrones. And, like, again, it feels like him again, and it feels like we're in his world. And I know that this whole story, having read it, feels that way throughout. And so I think that this show will succeed on that merit, is my prediction. Like, I think the show's going to do well. You know, and I think it will bring some people back. Will it forgive the wrongs? No. And, like, and does that make me feel better about season 8? Not at all. Season 8 was a disaster. Season 7 was kind of a disaster too, especially in retrospect. So,
I mean, when things start changing, like, we can say seasons 1 through 4 we were really happy with, and things start to change, and there's great scenes in some of those seasons later.
Oh, sure. But Battle of the Bastards, you know, happens later. Think of Sapochnik. Yeah, and, like, that hasn't happened in the books yet. So, like, there were moments where we had reasons to hope, but it just, you know, it just didn't work out.
I'll end by basically just saying that I'm not going to let something that eventually happens in the story affect this self-contained story and my enjoyment of it.
View it as a self-contained story. It's going to have its own arc, and I think it's going to be enjoyable in its own right, you know, and it's going to be shocking and dark and brutal, but have moments of fuck yeah cheers, you know, like Game of Thrones does when it's at its best. And I think we're going to get that. And the show, to me, looks great. I mean, the costuming's amazing. It's got that, like, it's just got that feel that, like, the show has, where it's like they are putting the effort in to make it look fantastic, to get everything right. And I hope that speaking of Lord of the Rings, I hope that it feels the same way, right? Like, I hope when I'm watching that show, I'm gonna say a show where they put in the effort, because you get that in those original films too. Anyway, once again, we're getting too big.
Yeah, a feather in the cap of HBO right now as we're ending this conversation is just the first episode of House of the Dragon was the highest viewership of any HBO premiere ever.
Yeah, I saw that. So that's encouraging.
That's good on them, and I think people are interested.
I bet there was a big sigh of relief when that happened, because there's a lot of worry about it.
At the end of season 8 of Game of Thrones, I thought that people forgot about Game of Thrones, and it seems like there's still a thirst for it. So.
Let me also just say I'm so glad that all 10 episodes didn't drop, and that this is going to be an ongoing conversation. I just, personally, I
it's a big part of Game of Thrones.
I occasionally like binging, but sometimes I think it's just better to prolong satisfaction, I guess. I don't know.
I agree, especially in the case of a show like this, like event television.
Exactly. All right, well, we better wrap this thing. Until next time.
Keep adapting.